Okay, so let's get started. And ask my robot. I don't have one, but the reason I said ask my robot is it sounded more personal than ask your robot, or ask a robot, or ask the robot. Okay? So it's not really my robot. And so we know that computers can answer questions. You've seen examples of that. But the purpose of this talk is to have you understand exactly how computers answer questions. What do they do in order to find the answer? And for the purpose of this talk, my affiliation at the School of Computer Science at Carnegie Mellon is in the Language Technologies Institute. CMU has a School of Computer Science, which is, you could think of it as like a School of Engineering. So School of Engineering has chemical engineering, electrical engineering, civil engineering, many different departments.
And computer science, boss.
Well, for you, not in our place.
No,
big rivalry there. Okay. So the School of Computer Science at Carnegie Mellon has 8 different departments, and one of those departments is the Language Technologies Institute. We take a very broad view of what a language technology is. A lot of people think that language technologies is computer translation, for example, English to Chinese. And that's one example of a language technology. Another is search engines. So Google is certainly a language technology because you're typing in some keywords and it's got to find documents that have those keywords, and you may not know this, it also does some language translation. Even though you may not want it to, it will find documents in other languages that have words that appear when translated from your keyword into those languages. Another language technology is the genetic code. So the means by which animals reproduce and they give instructions on how cells should grow up. It's a long sequence of a very small alphabet of characters, but a very long sequence. And we believe that there's a language there. It's the language of life. And so we have a whole research group in the Language Technologies Institute that studies digitized DNA. They're not biologists. They don't know anything about biology. But they know a lot about informatics. Okay. I don't need to do this because Paul did it already. Okay, so. Can machines answer questions? Can we tell humans from machines by asking questions that, I should put in there, we think require human knowledge or intelligence? And here's an example of a trick that is used to try to distinguish humans from machines. It's called the CAPTCHA, Completely Automated Public Turing Test to Tell Computers and Humans Apart. Okay, so it's an acronym, but they didn't include every one of the letters of all of the words. It's the CAPTCHA. You've undoubtedly seen these things. So you go to websites, and they're concerned that some automated piece of software, a robot of some kind, is going to come along and make inquiries into this website and take a lot of information and use it for purposes that the owner of the website doesn't want it used for. But humans, because they can only type at a certain speed, the total amount of information that you could ever extract from one of these websites is quite small, limited by your manual typing capability. So somehow, if they could tell the difference between a human and a machine, they could keep out the machines and only let in the humans. So the idea here is that supposedly machines have a tough time understanding that that's the word overlooks and that that's the word inquiry. But humans, we're brilliant. And so we see this immediately, and we type overlooks inquiry and hit enter, and then it will distinguish us from robots and monkeys, because monkeys don't seem to have the capability of typing overlooks inquiry. And so not only does it keep out the robots, it keeps out the lesser animals also. Well, as it turns out, the CAPTCHA was invented by a colleague of mine, Carnegie Mellon professor Louis Van Aan. He's many decades younger than I am, and he's a very clever guy. The company that he created that licenses these things was sold to Google in 2009. He's a very wealthy guy, much richer than I am, but still a wonderful, wonderful person. Okay, now, the problem with CAPTCHAs, and you've probably wondered, how difficult is it to defeat this? Suppose you wanted to write a computer program that specifically oriented itself toward CAPTCHAs to see if it could pretend to be a human. The problem with these things is that they're either much too hard for humans or much too easy. So Crucified, any OCR program that does text recognition is easily going to recognize Crucified. That doesn't take any human intelligence. And this word has been so contorted that I can't even tell what it is. Now, how about this one? This can't distinguish anybody from anybody, because even humans can't read what that word is in there. I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is. Okay? And so we have to go beyond this. This simple character recognition is just not going to cut it. Because as computer algorithms become more refined, you have to make these tougher and tougher and tougher to the point where humans can't even do them. So the whole purpose of the test is lost. So let's try something different. Give you an example of why we have to try something different. This is a legal case. I didn't promise not to talk about law, so I will. The Ticketmaster case. Ticketmaster sued a company called RMG Technologies. You may have heard of Ticketmaster. You've never heard of RMG Technologies. It's a local Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania company, which is where Carnegie Mellon is. So there was a 2007 lawsuit involving these CAPTCHAs. Ticketmaster is a website that sells tickets to various entertainment events, sports events, concerts, etc. They're honest. They're not scalpers. They buy the tickets in blocks from the event, and they sell them at a fair markup. They don't want scalpers showing up, buying up all the tickets so the public can't get in, and then the scalpers resell them on eBay at 10 or 100 times the price. They don't like that. That would defeat the whole concept of Ticketmaster. So, to try to stop this, their website contains a terms of use link. So way down in small characters at the bottom of the Ticketmaster page is a little link that says terms of use. And if you care, most people don't, but if you care about the terms of use, you click on that, and this is one of the terms you're going to get. When purchasing tickets on Ticketmaster.com, you are limited to a specified number of tickets for each event, also known as a ticket limit. Boy, I don't think you had to be too intelligent to figure that out. This amount is included on the unique event page and is verified with every transaction. So the total number of tickets you can buy might be different. This concert may allow you to buy 6 tickets. That one might only allow you to buy 4 tickets. This policy is in effect to discourage unfair ticket buying practices. Okay? Let's continue. This is the key one. You agree that you will not use any robot, spider, or other automatic device, process, or means to access the site. It means you got to do it from a browser, typing it with your own hands. You agree that you will not take any action that imposes an unreasonable or disproportionately large load on our infrastructure, our servers. You agree you will not access, reload, or refresh transactional event or ticketing pages or make any other request to transactional servers more than once during any 3-second interval. So they believe if you're limited, you can type very fast, but if you're limited to something every 3 seconds, then the total number of tickets you could ever buy is going to be pretty small. Because for a very popular event, there are tens of thousands of other people out there who are also typing, and they're going to get in the queue ahead of you during that 3-second period when you can't type anything. So they believe that this is fair. You can still buy a fair number of tickets this way, but it doesn't overload their servers. Now, how do they enforce this? It's not a matter of trust. They use CAPTCHAs. So you can prove that you're human and you're not a robot, spider, or other automatic device. So here's the Ticketmaster CAPTCHA. Does anybody have any trouble recognizing that word? No. Okay, fine. So humans at least can recognize it. The question is, can anything other than a human recognize it? So here's what happened. This RMG Technologies of Pittsburgh company developed software called the Ticket Broker Acquisition Tool, the TBAT. Now, RMG Technologies never bought or sold a single ticket. They don't do that. They sell a software system to scalpers. The scalpers then use this ticket broker acquisition tool to buy up huge numbers of tickets through Ticketmaster. Well, the only way they could do that, of course, was to break the Ticketmaster CAPTCHA. They had to be able to recognize what that word was so they could immediately enter it into Ticketmaster and prove that the software was human. Obviously, there's something wrong with that method of proof. Okay, They prove that they're human. They flooded, this system floods Ticketmaster with thousands of automated requests. The idea is you fill up the entire queue with your requests so that no legitimate person ever has any chance of buying any tickets. And that enables these scalpers to purchase large numbers of tickets to popular events. In the lawsuit, the evidence came out that one customer of RMG that bought the ticket broker acquisition tool made 425,000 ticket requests to Ticketmaster in a single day. Now, that's more than one every 3 seconds, actually. Okay. Now, after the lawsuit, Ticketmaster changed its CAPTCHA because it needed to raise the threshold of how intelligent are these optical character recognition programs? Well, can you read that? No. Okay, so now humans have trouble buying tickets, and the robots have no chance. Okay, so they achieved, they achieved what they wanted to do, probably with some reduction in revenue, because legitimate people get fed up with this, and they forget about it. They won the lawsuit. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay, so here's a better test. Let's ask a question. The other one doesn't really ask a question. It just asks you to recognize something. So this is actually used. This is a map of the Washington, D.C. Metro. If you are at the Smithsonian Metro Rail Station, and there's the Smithsonian right there, and head west on the blue or orange line, what is the next station you will reach? This is very clever, because not only do you have to understand the question, you have to do some image processing to figure out what this is, and you have to know something about metro lines. I think it's really clever, because this is the blue line, and you're going west. But if you go west, the next station from Smithsonian is north. It's not west. It's on the west line. So you have to understand the concept of west. It doesn't mean monotonically west. It means you can go other ways. So the answer to this question is Federal Triangle. Federal Triangle is the next station after Smithsonian if you head west on the blue line. Okay? Well, that's a question, right? What would it take for a machine to answer the question? Could we write a piece of software that could defeat this kind of CAPTCHA? And the answer is, of course. Okay? So I want to distinguish the concept of searching versus question answering. When you have a question, you want to know something. I wanted to know something earlier today. I wanted to know, what are the four countries in the world that the United States has no diplomatic relations with? And I'll explain in a moment why I wanted to know that.
North Korea.
North Korea is one of them. Okay, but there are three others. One is not obvious. I think the other two are sort of obvious. Okay, so how do you use a computer to answer that question? You develop a keyword query. You take some keywords, and if you're really a sophisticated Google user, you use some Boolean connectors, you know, and, not, etc. But if you're not sophisticated, you just keep typing in keywords. And hopefully when the search page shows up with the little squibs from the hits, you'll see something that seriously indicates to you that the answer is probably on that page. And then you go look at the page. But you can't ask the question directly to Google, because it knows nothing about questions and it doesn't answer them. All it does is maybe point you to some place where you might find out for yourself. This is an unnatural act. I mean, humans do not interact with one another through Boolean queries. All right? Well, when I'm asking you a question, I don't formulate it as keywords separated by ands, nots, and parentheses. All right? So ultimately, we can't use the Google search bar to answer questions. But this is the process of using a search engine. You have a question. You distill it down to two or three keywords. You read some search hits, and maybe you find the answer. The search engine takes your keywords, finds the documents that has them, and delivers them back to you so you can hunt around. And the hunting may take quite a bit of time. What we would really like to have is question answering, where the human could type a natural language question into the computer. The computer would do some things, like, for example, understand the question, which is, Google doesn't do that. Produce some possible answers, because rarely will it be that instantaneously it just knows the answer. There might be some trial possibilities that it then has to distinguish among through the use of other evidence, other supporting evidence. So the idea is it should do all that, deliver the responses to you along with the evidence and its confidence in the answer, so you can make your own evaluation as to what the correct answer is. You're invited to come in.
Yeah.
You can even take Paul's seat, because he's not coming back. Paul Chung is not coming back. Okay. Well, not tonight. All right. So, IBM, which constantly wants to be at the top of the computer world, is regularly setting challenges for itself to show people that computers can do great things. And about 6 years ago, it set itself the challenge of playing the game Jeopardy. If you're not familiar with it, I'll show it to you in a second. But a challenge that IBM set for itself a couple of decades ago was chess playing. Because it was believed that no animal below the level of human was capable of playing chess. And most humans aren't really very good chess players. So if a computer could beat the world champion at chess, the computer must be incredibly intelligent. Possibly more intelligent than anybody on Earth. So IBM did this. They created a computer program that could play at a world championship level. And as soon as they were finished with it, all of us realized that it wasn't any intelligence at all. Because the way they achieved it was simply by adding more processing power. The trick in chess is to be able to look many moves ahead. If you can look one more move ahead than the best human, you can beat the human. How do you look more levels ahead? You add more and more processors in parallel, looking at the different potential positions. And so after it's over, we say, well, there was no trick to that. That's not really intelligent. And so, years went by. And then IBM sets this new goal, which everybody who looks at it says, oh, if you could do that, that would really be intelligent. So let's see. Here's the Jeopardy game. It is regarded by some, many, maybe, as a test of human intelligence. In Jeopardy, it's a weird format. They give you a quote answer, and you have to come up with the question to which that is the answer. It's a formatting thing. Okay? So here's an example. There are categories in Jeopardy. So U.S. cities, country clubs, authors. And here is the Jeopardy answer. St. Petersburg is home to Florida's annual tournament in this game, popular on ship decks. And if you know the answer, you have to phrase it in the form of a question. And so if you know, you'll say, what is shuffleboard? Okay? So if the question is, what is shuffleboard? The answer would be, it's a game popular on ship decks to which St. Petersburg is home to Florida's annual tournament. Okay? It's just weird. Okay? So Rochester, New York grew because of its location on this. It's very interesting because Rochester, New York, it's on the ground, isn't it? But that's not the right answer. It didn't grow because it's on the ground. It grew because it's on a lake, and lakes create commerce. So it seems you have to really know something here. It's also on lots of other things. It's on the map, isn't it? Rochester, New York is on the map. So if you made a list of all the things that Rochester is on, only a few of them would relate to its growth. And the belief is that only humans know that. Computers can find lots of things that Rochester is on, but couldn't really distinguish which one of them related to its growth. Okay? In India, the shashpar was a multi-bladed version of this spiked club. Well, okay, you probably don't know too many different spiked clubs. So you might get lucky and say mace, if that's the only one you know. But if you know lots of spiked clubs, then you have to find one that's a version of the shashpar. And you probably have to know a lot about Indian culture to do that. So you gotta be smart. That's the way Jeopardy is. So this is actually a massive problem. Because you have to understand what's being asked. Then you have to search around in places that don't actually have the answer, but have evidence that's related to the answer. This is not a lookup problem. You can't look this up. There's no reference that says, St. Petersburg is home to Florida's annual shuffleboard tournament, which is a game that is popular on ship decks. That sentence probably doesn't occur anywhere on Earth. Little pieces of it might occur. So, St. Petersburg is home to Florida's annual tournament. Well, there are probably lots of annual tournaments that take place in Florida, in St. Petersburg, Florida. But only a few of them would relate to a game that's popular on ship decks. So you have to know something about life. I mean, you have to know what goes on ship decks. Right? So the idea is if a computer could do this, it could be really great. So This is the question. I'll give you some examples. So the questions have dollar values, and I've translated these into Hong Kong dollars. In U.S. dollars, it's considerably lower. The juice of this bog fruit is sometimes used to treat urinary tract infections. All right, well, you have to know what a bog is, and you have to know which fruits grow in a bog. And if you're like me, the only one you know of is a cranberry. So you're immediately going to say cranberry because you don't know any other bog fruits. You might be right or wrong. And as it turns out, that is actually the right answer to that one. So these things have different dollar values. And the way the game is played is there are three contestants. The question or this answer is presented, and everybody has a buzzer. And the lucky person who's able to hit the buzzer first gets the opportunity to answer the question. If they get the right answer, then they win this amount of money. If they get it wrong, they lose that amount of money. So there's a heavy penalty for getting it wrong. Which means you might think you know the answer, but if you're not really sure, you might not want to try. In fact, if you don't think you have a greater than 50% chance of answering it properly, then your expectation would be negative. Right? You lose that money more often than you'll win that money. So you may not even try. So not only do you have to be able to answer these things, but you have to have a numerical idea of how right you think you are. What's your confidence in your belief that you've gotten the right answer? Okay. So, of the four countries in the world that the U.S. does not have diplomatic relations with, the one that's farthest north. That's why I had to look that up. I didn't know the four countries. And the one that's farthest north is probably pretty obvious. It's North Korea. But the U.S. does not have this is information useful at your next cocktail party in case anybody asks you. The other three countries are Cuba, which is not a surprise, Iran, which is really not a surprise, and Bhutan. And that's sort of a surprise because the U.S. and Bhutan are friendly. But we don't have formal diplomatic relations because Bhutan's pretty small and we don't have any trade with them and there's no real reason for us to have an embassy there. So everything is handled through the Indian embassy. Okay, that's the answer to that. So the domain is very broad. Almost anything is fair game in these questions. The language is very complex. Sometimes it's even difficult for a human to understand exactly what is being asked for in the question. High precision, meaning you've got to narrow down very quickly on a space of potential answers. Confidence is required because if you're not sure you know the answer, you don't want to try. And you have to do this very fast because the computer's going to play against humans. And humans are ringing in within seconds. So you have to do it faster than people. Otherwise, you could be brilliant, but you'll never have a chance to answer a question because one of the other contestants will get there before you. So because of all these things, this was regarded as a problem that was really going to require some serious intelligence. So here are the steps in answering a question. So I've chosen this one, the juice of this bog fruit is sometimes used to treat urinary tract infection. So every language has interesting aspects to its syntax. One of the characteristics of English is that it has a very defective verb system. We don't have many different tenses of verbs. And we don't have many different forms of nouns. Unlike many European languages. The European language, you look at the ending of a word, you can tell what part of speech it is, what its use is in the sentence. In English, you can't do that. Also, we make tremendous use of what are called noun phrases. So if I take two nouns and put them together, the first noun tends to be like an adjective modifying the second noun. So bog fruit. Bog is a noun. It means a muddy, kind of wet place where things grow. And fruit is a noun. But when you say bog fruit, bog is an adjective. It's a noun, but it's used as an adjective to modify fruit. It's fruit that grows in a bog. Well, how do you know that? Just because you put two nouns together doesn't mean that the second is something that grows in the first place. That has to do with what the nouns are. Bog and fruit. I'll give you an example. Urinary tract infections. Urinary tract infection is a noun phrase that has three nouns in it. Well, two nouns. Urinary tract is one, and infection is another. Well, a urinary tract infection, urinary tract modifies infection. It's an infection that occurs in the urinary tract. So understanding urinary tract infection is a lot different from understanding bog fruit. So just understanding what's being asked here How can you tell what's being asked? Well, we're going to parse this sentence. So the first thing the question answer has to do is understand the question, figure out what it's asking, and the way it does that is it tries to parse. So I hearken back to my days in elementary school where we learned to parse English sentences. So the juice of this bog fruit. So juice, okay, of bog fruit is, this is modifying juice. It's a particular kind of juice. It's a juice that comes from a bog fruit. And then there's the key word, this. The juice of this bog fruit. That turns out to be the key to telling you what's being asked for in the sentence. Okay? So it's the thing that this modifies. It's what's being asked for. Is used to treat infections and urinary tract modifies them. And so you parse this out. You find that this is a demonstrative adjective. It's the only one in the sentence. And so what's being asked for is a bog fruit. Whatever the answer, the correct answer is going to be, it's got to be a bog fruit, or it's not going to be the correct answer. Okay? Now, it's the relationship between the word this bog fruit. That's what's being asked for. Great. So now let's look at some strategies. Well, you can't look up the answer, because I'm sure that there's no medical textbook that says urinary tract infections are treated by juice of bog fruit. Okay, there might be a book that says it's treated by cranberry juice, but it's not going to say by a bog fruit, a virtual guarantee. So you can't look it up. And so keyword search is going to produce huge numbers of references, but they may not give you that much of a clue to the answer. Okay, there might be a medical article that associates cranberries with urinary tract infections. There also might be a botanical article that associates cranberries with bog fruits. And in fact, it may list lots and lots of different bog fruits, but has nothing to do with urinary tract infections. But if you could put the medical journal article together with the botanical article, then you would have enough information to answer the question, if you knew to do that. So here's strategy one. Let's make a list of all bog fruits that we can find. Part of the strategy one is step two. Let's make a list of all known treatments for urinary tract infections. And let's match them up. See if anything occurs on both the bog fruit list and the urinary tract infection list. And then do it all within 3 seconds. And then you have a chance at answering this question before a human might. Okay? Now, when I put it this way, maybe it doesn't even sound that intelligent. It sort of sounds like it's just a lot of fast lookup. Okay? Well, we'll see. Okay. So the strategy requires lots of information. So being able to look at a document and tell that it's really talking about a treatment of urinary tract infections, not diagnosis of them, not what the symptoms are, not the horrible things that can happen to you from urinary tract infections, but how do you actually treat them? Okay? And it may not use the word treat. It may use something else. Okay? Where is all this information going to come from that Watson, the system that IBM built, is going to use to answer these questions? The answer is that it came from the web. And the reason it came from the web is that we know how to spider the web, and people usually don't mind when you visit their document on their website. People do mind if you take a copyrighted book and stick it into an optical scanner and scan it, because that's a copyright infringement, and IBM certainly was not going to engage in mass copyright infringement. So it would be nice if you could take every medical journal article ever written, most of them are under copyright, scan them, OCR them, and index them. But IBM couldn't do that. So they went to the web, and they ingested a huge amount of information. Web pages, about 200 million web pages were ingested into Watson. And then they were indexed for fast retrieval, sort of similar to what Google does. Now, when a question is asked, so it comes out to be about 200 million pages of text, it's the equivalent of about 1 million books. 1 million books is a fair number. The Hong Kong U Library has a lot more than 1 million, but Carnegie Mellon has only about 1 million. So it's the equivalent of a decent college library, but not a great college library. Okay? So a question is asked, and here's a Jeopardy type question. This type of vigil happens annually outside Graceland. Well, okay, Graceland is a place, but it's not a city. It's not on the map. I mean, it's the place where Elvis Presley was born or something, or Elvis Presley lived or died, or he did something in Graceland. And what's a vigil? It's some kind of sacred ceremony, right? People sit around and look somber at one another at a vigil. And so there's an annual vigil outside Graceland. Well, how many vigil types are there? I don't know of one. Maybe a wake is a vigil type. But what they mean something different, okay, by this. What they mean is it's this Elvis Presley event that occurs annually. Okay. So what you have to do is start analyzing the question. You do a topic analysis. Well, it's a type of vigil is the answer, right? Because the word this, type of vigil, the only correct answer. Happens annually in Graceland. Of course, it's outside Graceland. It's not in Graceland. After you've gotten the key concepts, these 200 million pages of text are searched in parallel to see which ones seem to be relevant to vigils, things happening annually, and Graceland, and all three of those together. Then what happens is various candidate answers are generated by phraseology from those web pages. So a candlelight vigil, an all-night vigil, an annual vigil, I don't know, whatever other kind of vigil was referred to in those documents. Now Watson has to come along and kind of distinguish one from the other and decide which one is probably the correct answer. And so what it does is it obtains content that is relevant to these various candidate answers, and then determines some level of confidence that it has as to whether this one, that one, or the other is correct. This is a very difficult one to deal with because these aren't very different from one another. So when I show you how it does it, I'm going to use, a much better example. Now, how the web content was ingested. This was done by technology at the Language Technologies Institute at CMU. We didn't build Watson, but we did build the piece that went out and analyzed the text, did first syntactic framing, that is pure parsing, finding what the subject, verb, and object is in every sentence in 200 million pages of text. Then we created, and when I say we, it wasn't me, it was my colleagues, created semantic frames, which are basically inferences that one was able to make from these 200 million pages. So here's an inference. Who patents inventions? People. But only people who invent things can patent inventions. So inventors patent inventions. Who resigns from things? Well, many people resign, like employees resign, but officials submit resignations. Employees submit resignations. Apes do not submit resignations. Not that I know of. Okay? People earn degrees at schools. Dogs do not earn degrees at schools. People do that. Okay? Fluid is a liquid and liquid is a fluid. I'm not sure I agree with those. Okay? It would seem to mean that they're the same thing, but they're not. Vessels sink. Right? Boats don't fly. Boats sink. They either float or sink. Right? They can't go up. People sink, but they don't sink themselves. As a direct object, they sink pool balls. They sink eight balls. And they also do sink if they drown. So people can sink. And vessels can sink. So there's a lot of information that one can get out of these 200 million pages of text without being human. You don't have to know any, you don't have to have lived to know these things. You can know these things from the way they are expressed in those 200 million pages of text. Okay. So. Oh, so this has to do with the probability that it believes that this is correct. That it thinks with probability 0.8 that it's inventors that patent inventions. It's not positive because it doesn't really know what an inventor is. It's read a lot of pages that talk about inventors, but it doesn't really know, like we know. Okay? And it has lower confidence for some of these other things. Okay. Now, here's how Watson proceeds. First, it analyzes the question. It does a primary search to retrieve content related to the question. And it has both structured text and structured unstructured text, like web pages. And structured knowledge base entries, like an almanac, has organized charts and matrices that list, for example, the top 100 cities in the world in population. So if you ask Watson that, it knows it instantly because it just goes right out and looks it up. But other stuff that it can't look up, it has to get from analyzing this unstructured text. By unstructured text, it's just stuff that people wrote that happens to show up in web pages. It then generates candidate answers from the retrieved content. And you'll see some of them are funny. Some of them are clearly way off. But then it weeds out the ones that it doesn't like. Then for each candidate answer, it retrieves more content related to that answer to see if it can get some corroborating evidence that would lead it to believe with higher probability that that's the correct answer. It performs scoring. It looks at the type of evidence, how much evidence did we get that supports the candidate answer. If there's lots of evidence from reliable sources, this confidence is very high in the answer. If there's only sparse evidence and it's from shaky places, then Watson's not so confident about it. Then it considers everything together, produces a final ranked list of answers with confidences, and it'll take the top one if it believes that the chance is greater than 50% that it'll answer the question. Because if it's below 50%, its expected value is negative. Right? That's what it does. Easy to say. Let's see how it does it. So here's a question. Each year, the EU selects capitals of culture. One of the 2010 cities was this Turkish meeting place of cultures, where meeting place of cultures is in quotes. So I guess there's some phrase that people have referred to this city by as the meeting place of cultures. I've never heard that before. And of course, what is it asking for? It's asking for this Turkish thing. Well, whatever the answer is, it's got to be a meeting place of cultures, and it's got to be Turkish. I don't know how many Turkish meeting places of cultures there are, but Watson's going to find them. So it has to analyze the question. And it analyzes the question by doing a parse. And it figures out where this is. And this is referring to a place. How does it know it's a place? Because it has to be one of cities. Cities are places. And so therefore, this Turkish meeting place of cultures must be a city. It's not just like a building. It's a city. Okay? So it does a parse. And then, over here, it goes out and it searches all kinds of things that might be meeting places of cultures. Brussels. Well, isn't that where the EU lives? Brussels. And all the different European cultures kind of meet in Brussels. I'm not sure why Essen is there. We know why Turkey's there, because it's the right answer. Ottawa, there's the French culture and the British culture in Canada, and Ottawa is very close to the borderline there. Not bad. Sarajevo, that's the way it's pronounced, by the way. It's not Sarajevo. It's Sarajevo. Sarajevo, it's a meeting place of the different cultures in the former Yugoslavia, right? The Slavs and the Muslims. Istanbul, which is in Turkey, and Pécs, Hungary. Okay, so it's found, out of all those 200 million documents, it's found these candidate answers that might be a meeting place of cultures. Well, it's clear that Turkey is Turkish. But you're only going to find out that Istanbul is Turkish if you get more facts about Istanbul. So now we're going to go for each of these things and we're going to get very specific evidence out of our database pertaining to each of those things. And then eventually we're going to narrow it down. We're going to find there's some confirming evidence for Istanbul, Sarajevo, and Essen. I don't know why Essen, what cultures meet there. Then the evidence is weighed. And so for each of these three candidate answers, it's going to score them on a bunch of different rating categories. I'll show you what those are later. And you can see that certain of the answers show up very well in certain categories, like this green bar, but in other categories, it's the worst. It's the best here, but the worst there. So it's got to take all this evidence now and say, what's the really best answer, and how confident am I that that really is the best answer? And so in its next step, it decides that Istanbul is the right answer with probability 84%. And so that's way over 50%. So it's happy to ring in and answer what is Istanbul, which happens to be the correct answer. And Essen and Sarajevo are way, 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 way down. All right. So how does it establish confidence? Here are the different measures. Document support. How many documents are there that seem to support this answer? Now, just because there are lots of documents doesn't mean it's the right answer. The documents may be bogus. They may be incorrect. There may be only one document on earth that happens to have the correct answer. And so it's going to score very low on document support. That doesn't mean it's wrong. Logical justification. Does it meet all of the syntactic requirements of the question? Is it, for example, a city? If it's not a city, then it can't be a correct answer to that question because the question had the word city in there. Popularity. Ah. So how many times on the web has there been some statement that seems to be confirming the answer? Popularity, of course, is not a guarantee of correctness. Temporal. Did it occur at the right time? And type match. Does the answer properly match the type of thing that was requested? And so you can see that Sarajevo was extremely popular. And the reason for that was at around that time, there was conflict in Sarajevo and there were huge numbers of news stories about it. And so that just because it's popular doesn't mean that the answer is correct. So the correct answer, Istanbul, showed up very well here, but not at the top. It was the top here, the top here, the top there, and the top there. And that's probably the reason that Watson decided that Istanbul was the correct answer. Okay? Now, this is a simplified view of the Watson architecture. Shows you what it does. And some of this is repetitious of what we've done before. Take the question, you analyze the question and the topic, because every question in Jeopardy, there's a topic, a subject at the top. So U.S. cities, for example, is one of the topics. If it falls within the U.S. cities category, even if it doesn't say so in the question, the answer has to be a U.S. city. So there's extra information that it processes. It then generates hypotheses of what is being asked for, and then goes out and does this huge search in the answer sources, the 200 million pages. Then after that, I think there's a little animation here. Yes. So there are multiple possible interpretations of the question. For each hypothesis, it finds hundreds of sources. From those, it generates hundreds of possible answers. It then goes over and evaluates thousands of pieces of evidence to see if it can confirm those answers. And then it creates hundreds of thousands of scores because you have to take for every possible answer and every possible source, you have to devise a score for that. Takes all of that stuff and merges it in this model that it has of how reliable various kinds of information are. Then it takes all that information, takes all that information and does a final confidence merge and ranking. That is, it takes all the answers and it assigns a probability of correctness to each of them. And sometimes it's way off. I mean, sometimes it says with 95% this is the correct answer and it's like dead wrong. But, you know, it's not human after all. Alright, so now I'll show you the analysis that it does for a really good question. In 1698, this comet discoverer took a ship called the Paramore Pink on the first purely scientific sea voyage. You probably know the answer, because you probably don't know too many comet discoverers, and the one comet discoverer you know happens to be the correct answer here. So it wasn't so tough for you. But it's not so easy for Watson, because Watson doesn't know comet discoverers. Okay? And I'll bet you didn't know that comet discoverer took a ship called the Paramore Pink, which is like a really strange name for a sailing vessel anyway. And that was the first purely scientific sea voyage. It was before the Beagle, before Darwin. Okay? So, what does Jeopardy do with this? It plucks out some keywords. 1698 is going to be very important if it recognizes that as a year date. Humans immediately see that, oh, that refers to the year 1698. But it could be a building number. Okay? Like, we're in 119. Right? That doesn't mean that it was 2,000 years ago. Right? So it has to parse it and figure that out. So this comet discovery, Paramore, Pink, it determines that the answer type is a comet discoverer because it says this comet discoverer. But comet discoverer is a noun phrase. Right? It's two nouns put together that have a unitary meaning. All right. So the discoverer took a ship and the ship was called the Paramore Pink. So it creates some relationships here. So it's now going to go out and search to see if it can find those relationships in the 200 million pages. So it looks for related content, both structured and unstructured. And it came out with these tentative answers, some of which are funny. Isaac Newton.
Yeah.
Wilhelm Temple. I don't know who that was. The HMS Paramore, which we can recognize as a ship, but Watson doesn't know that that's a ship. It might be somebody, it might be some British guy whose first three initials are HMS. Okay? Christian Huygens. Halley's Comet. Halley's Comet is not a discoverer. Edmund Halley is a discoverer. The Pink Panther. And the actor Peter Sellers. Now, Peter Sellers, I don't think, discovered any comets, but Watson doesn't know that. And where it comes up with this, it has to do with pink. And so when it searches for pink, it sees lots of references to the movie Pink Panther, and Peter Sellers was an actor in the movie The Pink Panther. So it tries all these things, and now it's going to look for confirming evidence. And it's not going to find too much confirming evidence for Peter Sellers, I'm pretty sure. So it retrieves evidence from the database that relates to these specific things. So it learns a lot about the life of Peter Sellers to see if he ever took any sea voyages in 1698. And I don't think it found that he did. Okay? Then it scores each piece of evidence on these various categories. Did it occur at the right time? Did it occur at the right place? Is it lexically correct? Is it actually a comet discoverer? Scores all of those things and then came out with this. It believed that Edmund Halley was the correct answer with probability 0.85. Christian Huygens with 0.20. And Peter Sellers with 0.05. Now, why did Peter Sellers survive into the final list? Probably because of popularity. The number of web pages that make reference to Peter Sellers is probably really huge. And the number of web pages that also have the word pink and Peter Sellers in it is probably really huge. So that's why it made it into the top three, but it's nowhere close to the top one. And so Watson would be perfectly happy to ring in on this, believing with probability 0.85 that it was going to answer the question correctly. Okay? Now, keyword evidence. In May 1898, Portugal celebrated the 400th anniversary of this explorer's arrival in India. Well, Portugal celebrated, but the explorer wasn't necessarily celebrated. Okay, it happened in May 1898. It has to recognize that that's a time. 400th anniversary means it's 400 years later than something. So we're going to have to go backwards 400 years to find out what happened. And it's Portugal that's doing the celebrating. But somebody arrived in India who was an explorer. Well, there are a lot of different pieces to that question. And so we got to go out and we got to find people who arrived in India 400 years ago. We have to find what Portugal celebrates. We have to find out what started in what happened in May 1898, etc. Okay, so there's a lot of work to do on this. Well, consider this. It finds a document that says in May, Gary arrived in India after he celebrated his anniversary in Portugal. Well, what you can see is that even though it doesn't confirm that Gary is an explorer, it satisfies a lot of the conditions of the question. And so it's got to distinguish Gary from the correct answer. So what it's going to do is it's going to go out and look for evidence about Gary to see if it can confirm that Portugal is celebrating him. And it's probably not going to find any confirming evidence, so it's going to throw out Gary as a possibility. But this is what happens when you don't actually know anything. Right? We know something. We understand what this means. Watson doesn't understand what that means. Watson just goes out and looks at documents to see if it can find things that confirm things. So it's fakey kind of intelligence. But you'll see when the game is actually played, fantastic things happen. All right, I want to move on to this one. I want to show you how clever Watson has to be in order to answer stuff like this. So the category is edible rhyme time. What that means is that every correct answer is going to involve a food and a rhyme. The words of the answer are going to have to rhyme with each other, and it has to pertain to a food. So the question is a long, tiresome speech delivered by a frothy pie topping. This is not so easy for humans to answer even, okay? And so what Watson does is it has to find out what kinds of things are long, tiresome speeches, and what kinds of things are frothy pie toppings. And so a diatribe is a long, tiresome speech, and a harangue is a long, tiresome speech, Whipped cream is a frothy pie topping, and meringue is a frothy pie topping. So the correct answer is actually meringue harangue. Because it's a food, meringue, and it has to rhyme, but it has to be a long, tiresome speech. So a meringue harangue would be a long, tiresome speech delivered by a frothy pie topping. So you can see that answering this question appears to require a tremendous amount of societal knowledge and understanding puns and knowing which words rhyme with one another. How does Watson figure out that these words rhyme? Because it has a pronouncing dictionary. It knows how to pronounce these words. And so it can tell whether two words rhyme or not. Okay. Now, so they go off and they build this. And they hired CMU to do the language processing part. They had many other researchers around the country and at IBM doing all this. They write the system and they run it. And it was pretty good. The problem was it took 2 hours to answer a question. And the Jeopardy program only lasts half an hour on television. So if you waste 2 hours answering the question, you're never going to even answer one question. So what do? They say, well, we can really exploit a lot of parallelism here. So they built a parallel computer that has 90 IBM Power 750 servers. It has 2,880 cores. Each one of them is a 3.55 gigahertz chip. The data path on these chips is huge. You can send 500 gigabytes per second on chip from one piece of the chip to another. Okay? All of these are connected in a 10 gigabit Ethernet network. I mean, if you've got a 1 gigabit network, you've got a fast network. This is a 10 gigabit network. It has 15 terabytes of RAM. This is like inconceivable. This is a really huge amount of main memory. 20 terabytes of disk. And it searches text using actually two public source systems, something called UIMA and Apache Hadoop. But it all fits in 10 racks. So there's a picture of it. And it would be much smaller than this room. I mean, it would all fit in that corner of the room. Not exactly portable. So when they take this on the road, they don't actually take this on the road. They connect to it over the internet. Because the total amount of data you have to send to it and receive from it is only a few bytes of information. So it stays home at IBM when they run it. It operates at 80 teraflops. So that's 80 trillion floating point operations per second. The human brain processing power is believed to be approximately 100 teraflops. So in raw power, it has as much power as a human brain. Of course, it's not as well organized. And it probably doesn't have as much memory as humans do. But it's 200 million times faster than the computer on the space shuttle. And after all, the space shuttle is able to do some pretty amazing things. So in 3 seconds, it parses a 2,000-foot shelf of books and picks out the relevant information and creates an answer. And it easily beats the best humans. This guy that's Ken Jennings. He was the all-time champion at Jeopardy. So he ends up playing against Watson, and he ends up with $24,000, and Watson ends up with $77,147. Now, they staged a contest like this at Carnegie Mellon. They had a team of 3 CMU students, 3 students from the University of Pittsburgh, and Watson. And Watson killed them. I mean, it wasn't even close. So like at the end, each of the student teams had about $3,000 and Watson had $50,000. And in the middle, the students made a request. They said, we think that Watson is being given an unfair advantage because the rules of Jeopardy are that you can't ring in on the question until the entire question has been asked. Whereas Watson gets it right at the start. And so they asked the guy who was giving the questions, would you please read the questions faster? Because that will give us a chance to ring in and give Watson less of a chance to gain an advantage over us.
Does the machine hear?
So there's a whole set of questions. They appear on the screen so that the human can read them to the humans. But at that moment, it's gone into Watson. It gets it digitally. Digitally, it gets it as a text string. So the students asked, would you please read the questions faster? And the MC did that, and it didn't help. they still lost horribly. Okay, well, anyway, if you see this, and you can probably find a video of it on YouTube, it's incredibly impressive. because the questions are really unbelievably sophisticated and they require what appears to be a tremendous amount of human knowledge. Well, I don't think we're getting anywhere with playing Jeopardy. I mean, at least chess is recognized as a worldwide contest that people really strive to do well in. I think Ken Jennings is one of the few guys who really was striving to do well in Jeopardy. This is not the ultimate purpose of Watson. So here are some future Watson applications. And the one that IBM is focused on right now is healthcare. Suppose you could take all medical textbooks, all medical journal articles that have ever appeared, put those into the text database of Watson, and then ask the question of this form. A patient who presents with this symptom and this symptom and this symptom probably has what disease? And if it can answer that, it will look up different sources. Not only will it give the answer, but it will give citations to the medical journal articles that it believes support its conclusion as to what the diagnosis is. So it basically could know, in a certain sense, at least as much book learning as any doctor could ever have, and more than any doctor could ever have. No, they're not proposing that you walk into a robotic medical clinic and it diagnoses and treats you. It's not that. It's supposed to be an aid to humans because there are a lot of conditions that the doctors never see in a lifetime that they have to be able to diagnose. Okay? And this is their big challenge. They believe that if they can do this, this will be one of the most valuable things the IBM Corporation ever did. But what you notice is there's all kinds of evidence that you get that relates to medical conditions. So the symptoms are important. But they're not necessarily exclusive. I mean, people show up with symptoms that have never presented before. They have this disease, and all of a sudden they have red splotches all over their forehead. And no human has ever had that before. So you can't rule it out. Family history is very important, as are your personal history. What is your personal health history? Medications you're taking or didn't take, and various findings in the past. What diagnoses have been made of you, and also what evidence are we going to get from your lab tests? All of these are different sources of information that confirm or refute various hypotheses. And so Watson takes all this information and it produces a diagnosis with a particular confidence level. And if the confidence is very high, then humans may end up relying on it. So what it does is it keeps taking information. This is a little animation. It's getting more and more information. This is about that urinary tract infection thing. And as it collects more and more information, it's changing its confidence level in what it thinks the answer is. And so all of these are possible diagnoses that are consistent with the symptoms that the patient had, including some things that don't appear to be closely related to one another, like flu and urinary tract infections don't seem to be closely related. But at the end, when it got all of the information, it concluded that urinary tract infection was the right diagnosis, and it's very confident of that. And so you can imagine, let's suppose that you were a stock brokerage or an investment bank, and you're looking around for which companies does Watson believe are going to increase in stock value in the next week. Okay, there's all kinds of information around available about that. And I'm not even talking about insider information. I'm talking about objective information available to anybody, but nobody has the processing power of Watson. So IBM is basically selling Watson. It's selling copies of Watson customized to various industries. And that, they believe, is going to be one of their big, big future businesses. Okay, well, we're at the end of time, and so I'll be happy to take questions.